My name is Eunice Scarfe, and although years and years ago I came to Holden as an American from Seattle, that was 1961, now I come as a London immigrant from Canada in Edmonton, Alberta. And you never get over evangelical upbringings. My evangelical fervor at the moment is Canadian fiction, which is what Ingrid and Jody talked to me about doing on the sessions while I was here. And Di Brandt, the author of Shades of Sin, is a Canadian writer, and she'll be one of the ones we're talking about today. So, secondly, you're in Shades of Sin, but you're also in a Canadian context. We're talking about multiculturalism this week. There are many directions you can look geographically, and I'm asking you to look north with me for a little while. What I find interesting is some similarities in the issues that are raised in the fiction in Canada, issues that we as members of religious communities can understand, can evaluate, and perhaps can appreciate. And Di Brandt is one that raises some of these issues. Perhaps you can guess by the title she's going to raise some of these issues. I suppose, and I don't mean this to be how much do you know about what I know, but I'm interested in what exposure, if any, you have to Canadian fiction. And if you wouldn't object just saying a few names or authors that have been familiar to you in your experience, I never know who's come across the border. The ones that we think are our most famous and most prolific writers are sometimes just totally unheard of, I discover, and obscure ones show up. Could you just give me a few names before we go on?
Robertson Davies.
Robertson Davies.
Farley Mowat.
And Farley Mowat.
Margaret Atwood.
Margaret Atwood, certainly.
Yes,
her, give me the name of the last one.
Handmaid's Tale. Yeah.
Handmaid's Tale. I'd highly recommend you. She's actually set that in Boston, in Harvard Yard. It's a futuristic tale of the outcome of a very... Well, it's the opposite of utopia. What is it? The outcome of a futuristic society, and very much from the point of view of women, where bearing children has been at such a high premium that the handmaid is the one that bears the children. Any others?
Some I'm trying to think of a comedian, famous comedian, a writer of comedy. Is it Lear or is it?
Stephen Laycock, maybe.
Huh?
Stephen Laycock is one of the early
Laycock, yes, Stephen Laycock, yeah.
And he's, I think, been anthologized.
Yeah.
What I find is, these are some of the Canadian writers that I've mentioned here, some of whom are in obscure journals, and I mention these stories for particular reasons today, and I'll have them if you want to read them off a reference shelf this week. What I find is that the stories, the ones you've mentioned are fine writers, and yes, they have come into the American mainstream. A lot of the fiction in Canada is published in small literary magazines or anthologized, and that's not picked up by the mass market in the States. So the way to do it is to skip Holden next year and come to Canada and spend a summer at the library, the bookstore, and you'll find access to these far more possible. I really throw up my hands when I come down here and try to find what I think are mainstream texts, and they're not in the bookstore. With the exception in Seattle of the... that waterfront bookstore.
Elliott Bay,
thank you. Keep going, I'll need you again, Ron. Elliott Bay Bookstore has a really fine selection. So, it's Canadian fiction. And more narrower than that, I'm looking at the portrayal of religious community in fiction. And I've chosen only Canadian fiction. We're going to look at one today. But my question is how and to what extent has the upbringing in a religious community shown up in fiction? Now, I would guess that there's more than one or two of you here who have grown up in religious communities, who can remember church every Sunday, who have memories of prayers together as a family. It is not necessarily the case, but at Holden, you can count on at least one or two in a group having some memories of how religious belief and experience inhabited, influenced the home, the upbringing, the community, and the ways in which that was manifest in lives. Now, that is of interest to me because I have, for the last 5 years, been writing fiction with a vengeance, and I thought I could write fiction without touching that whole piece of my life that has to do with religious community, with sitting in the pew more Sundays than I wanted to, with LCR and LDR and all the other acronyms that go with the ELC upbringing in the American church. I thought I could write without touching that. I thought, why would I want to touch that? Everybody I knew all about it anyway. And it's creeping into my writing. It invaded my writing. Then it went like a bomb and exploded into the writing. And I have a collection of stories, which every one of which has to do with touching on what dynamics existed between the way the belief of the church and the way it's manifest in people's lives, and the delicious ironies between a community, and it's set in a community, a fictional community, a community that preaches thou shalt love thy neighbor, and then the way in which that's actually made manifest. And there is once in a while a little bit of irony between what is believed and how this is lived. Actually, there's so much irony that's probably why I simply can't stop writing these stories. You know, there's just always one more. They're connected by virtue of characters, not by place. Sometimes you have a place, you know, and then all the stories take place in that place. The collection I'm just about finished with is two families in that community. So this has been a particular interest to me. Where is the fiction that shows this? You know, you always look for the models that came before you. I started looking in American fiction, and I need your help again, because I came up with a blank. Where, if at all, is a Lutheran, a Scandinavian, and I'm not implying that you all are, but this is my experience, and I was looking for that. I think we all, if we have a right to look for, in fiction, what our worlds are like. For any of you, whatever your own particular background is, where in fiction have you found yourself? Where in fiction has your story been told? Where in fiction have your antecedents? You can look at something like Thornbirds. That probably doesn't apply to very many of us, but that's antecedents for a whole group of people, is it not? Can you give me any antecedents that would be the fictional world that represents you on the page? And do you understand my question? I spent about 2 years thinking, it's probably just around the corner, and if I keep looking, and maybe it's because I've been away from the States and it's now, you know, on the show. But I know of virtually nothing. I told John Updike, please believe that I don't assume we're all Lutheran, but I am, so I'm talking about my search. I told John Updike was Lutheran, but that didn't help a whole lot. I don't think much of his world related to the kind of things I was interested in. Yes?
It doesn't fit my upbringing, but I would imagine that a lot of people would just see role models as being, you know, if they're born on the prairie and they came through the
giants in the earth.
Giants in the earth is the one eventually that I stopped it. That stops in 1920, doesn't it? Did you say that?
No, it does stop about then.
And it's very much the first generation. It is, in fact, the Scandinavian immigrant experience, which other immigrants can identify with. The woman goes mad because she can't see beyond the edge of the prairie. There's a beautiful, I mean, if madness can be beautiful, there's a beautiful rendering of her fear of what's beyond the edge. She can't get there, never will. What is beyond? And then the giants in the earth, which is the biblical quote, become those great cloud formations that she feels are watching her. Really terrifying. Yeah?
I just saw a wonderful movie called The Death's Feast,
which
is based on a short story by Isaac Dennison, and it deals with the Scandinavian very pietistic religious suffering.
I don't know that, thank you. A Dennison story.
Uh-huh.
Is the story the same name as the movie?
It's an Academy Award, and it's a movie. Yeah. And it's quite wonderful, but it's just based on Danish language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay.
Yes. Sophus Winther wrote books about, I relate to them because they wrote a book called Take All to Nebraska, and that's, if you find the mind, that one.
I don't know the name of anybody again.
Sophus Winther.
Winther.
He was at the University of Washington.
I see.
What about Carol Bly?
Yes, I've seen some of her. Yes, we certainly include that. I'd prefer to set you off with writing a short story right now, if you're done by 5 o'clock, and then you have an anthology, you know, we'd be done with having to search in obscure corners. In fact, I invite you to go home and get it done in 6 months and see to it that it's put into circulation. I found when I started writing, I had all kinds of stuff I was going to write about. I'd been away from the States for quite some time, and when I was ready to write, it was all sitting there. Unfortunately, it all stood aside, and the first story I did for a writing class was a little girl in a revival meeting who was getting terrified by the kind of rhetoric of the person front. It was an outdoor meeting. Do any of you remember these or been to one? You all escaped. It was fictional, it was real, but it was the child's growing fear of that movement towards some culmination. And this was entirely fiction, of course. I had never been there. I pretended to myself that this really was a fictional story. I had never experienced that kind of rhetoric or its effect on a child, which I think can be absolutely terrifying. And I made it a Baptist setting because there's no way I wanted, you know, sort of saying Lutheran was, it's very hard to explain. It was like Lutheran didn't show up on fiction's page. Catholics, Jewish stories exist. But how many times have you seen the Lutheran world on fiction's page? It just sort of seemed, well, it seemed I could go in disguise if I called it Baptist. Unfortunately, the professor says, these hymns are far too classy for a Baptist. I was found out. So he said, if you're going to write about your world, and I'm not suggesting this is your world, why don't you call it what it is? And it still took me a while to admit to it. I have a friend, someone called Gloria Sawai, who's been at Holden and is a very fine writer. She's written one of the most anthologized stories in Canada, whose title I should probably read to you, because it's also the longest title of any short story I've ever heard. And she said, I was 45 before I mentioned Lutheran on my pages. She always makes hers the United Church of Canada. Because she's been living, her father, she grew up in Minneapolis and then they moved to Saskatchewan. And it isn't out of shame or disguise, it's because it hasn't been created as a fictional world. Do you understand? It, you know, New York, we all know you could set a story in New York, can't you? But I'm not sure you've read too many set in Holden Village. You know, if it's been done before, you think it really, it does exist in fiction. If it hasn't appeared on fiction's page, there's that leap of faith. Am I going to be the one to create Lutherans into fiction? Try your story. You'll know the difficulty within 6 months. Do you want to hear Gloria's title? And then I'll get on to the real business. This is, Ingrid used this in the last week or two. So a few of you may have heard it. I don't know where Gloria got this title. She happens to be a close friend of mine now, though she's writing long before I did. And I intend to ask her one day. This is the title. The day I sat with Jesus on the sun deck and a wind came up and blew my kimono open and he saw my breasts. And it takes place in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. And the last line, you have to hear the last line. We can do this Wednesday if anybody wants to hear a real Lutheran story. That's what happened to me in Moose Jaw in 1972. It was the main thing that happened to me that year. It's a wonderful story. That's been anthologized in the Oxford Book of Canadian Stories, in the Oxford Women's Book of Canadian Stories, in the Alberta Anthology of Canadian Stories. Everyone loves it. Everyone. We're going to do Di Brandt today. Gloria's is here if you would like to read it. What interests me in the transition here about how we create our worlds into fiction and why we need to, and I'm not going to go into why we need to or why I think we need to, that's a whole other issue, is that there is a religious community in Canada which I think is in some ways not all that dissimilar to the Lutheran world or any other Protestant community, and they've suddenly mushroomed into having all sorts of fictional representations, and I don't know what happened to them, but their fiction, at least half a dozen writers, maybe it's that somebody takes the lead and the rest say, okay, it's time to put our story on the page. Do we need to read about everybody else's story? Is it time to write our own? This is just an aside, one of the reasons why I think perhaps we haven't done fiction is because music has been so emphasized in our church, has it not? Music is safe. That is an art form that we all endorse. It doesn't have ideas that are dangerous, at least not ones that we can easily get out. I'm sorry, this is my assumption as to why this is the case. Of course it has ideas, but there is almost 100% agreement that without music, our worship is poverty-stricken, is it not? Now, you can't plug fiction into our worship, but our religious experience has almost totally ignored, as far as I can see, and please disagree with me, the other art forms. Encouragement for, endorsement of, use of in worship or religious experience. This other community I'm talking about in Canada, which in the last 20 years has begun to produce a lot of fiction about its, not just writers from that community, but writing about their community, is the Mennonite community, and I fail to understand how this has happened, and I don't think they know how it's happened either. Di Brandt is a Mennonite with a Mennonite upbringing. She says she was brought up in the 16th century and leaped into the 20th when she went to university. If you know anything about the Mennonites, and perhaps you'll tell me what you know, because your Mennonite acquaintances in the States may be different than mine in Canada, that description of going from 16th to 20th century is very accurate.
They're very plain people.
Pardon?
The ones down in Oregon are very plain people.
All right, there's an emphasis
very
on plainness.
Clean, industrious, wonderful farmers.
Pacifist.
Pacifism is probably one of the most salient features. Yeah.
I just would like to say one thing. My favorite book when I was a kid was Tilly, the Mennonite Maid. I don't know where it is.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one. Any of the rest of you have experience with the history or the practice of religious?
We live about 10 miles from it. Mennonite community. We're at the U.S. side, but on the Canada side, Gretna and Altona, there's a whole,
Altona's
if you look
famous,
at the names
yeah.
of the communities, they're all heavy German sounding in that area. And there's one lady described, we're like Baptists, but not at all warlike. And yet the pacifism and care for the earth, Yoder, Y-O-D-E-R.
Yoder's been here. John mm-hmm. Howard Yoder is a theologian that's come here and is a pacifist theologian. The two, yes, Altona is a famous Mennonite town in Canada. The two Mennonites arose about the same time the Lutherans did during the Reformation. They thought the Lutherans didn't go far enough in separation of church and state. Very much took the authority unto themselves. Would not ever obey the authority of the state to go to war. They were pacifists always, have been from the beginning, still are, without any change, I believe. Very modest in their lifestyle, in what should we say, at least that's the ideal, there are exceptions, but modesty in lifestyle, very plain in terms of decoration of home and this kind of thing. As many schisms among the Mennonites as the Lutherans may have had in the early days, and please again forgive me for reference to what I know about, that except that they continue to encourage the schisms. The authority lies in the congregation. This enlarging of our church, what do you call it, what's the merger after merger after merger, they cannot understand. It's absolutely peculiar. Why on earth would you want such a big body? And why would you want to invest so much authority outside the congregation? So there are many, many, many divisions. So it's very difficult to talk about them in general. Di Brandt comes from near Altona. That's just in Winnipeg, or Winnipeg, isn't it? The first probably, and I've got these backwards. Again, I want to say that when I started looking for where is religious experience written about in fiction, I found a rich vein here, among other things. The first one that should be at the top, but I didn't put them in order, is Peace Shall Destroy Many. And that is a novel. The rest of these are short stories. A novel by someone called Rudy Weeb, who's in Edmonton now, was writing about a Saskatchewan community. And that is set in the 40s. You can probably get this in your bookstores and libraries in the States. It was set in the 40s. A community, a small Mennonite community, first generation Mennonite, still speaking German, and their resistance to war, to going into World War II. So it's the peace, attempting to keep the peace is destroying, and then who it's destroying, which is a number of things in the novel. This is Di's story, Questions I Asked My Mother. It's not just her story. It's Shades of Sin will come out of this, and I'll just talk about that for a minute. This book was published last year, Questions I Asked My Mother. She's from Winkler, Manitoba. She's probably 35 years old, 35 or 36, working on her PhD. She got a lot of reaction from her Mennonite world when she wrote this, and when I read you the story, you'll be able to see why. It was put up for the Governor General's Award, which I don't know if you know, is the annual award for best book. So she was nominated with three other books for the prize. It's a novel prize and a poetry prize and a fiction and poetry and drama prize. And that's a very high recommendation to get nominated for Governor General on her first book. So this is her collection. She's got quite a few short pieces in here. And then I'll just quickly go through these, and I've got these here if you want to read them in the course of the week. A Sunny Day in Canada is by David Toews, and it's a beautiful rendition of the death of an old woman, and it's written by the old man, both of them in the old folks' home. I think it's the sort of thing that should be read at every senior's funeral. It's so beautifully done. You might want to take a look at that. Wednesday Circle by Sandra Birdsell. Sandra Birdsell's in Winnipeg. She's written two collections of short stories. And they touch less on the Mennonite world. Her father was French-Canadian, the mother was Mennonite. But always it comes up. The Wednesday Circle is one of the stories, and it's about a small girl that's being abused by a neighboring farmer. And she thinks, if only I can get to the home where the Wednesday Circle is meeting, you know, the Martha Circle, the Ladies' Aid, whatever, if I can get there, their strength and their certainty and their power will protect me. And it doesn't. Or she doesn't get this in there. Homestead Crescent is Ruth Cron, who's in Albertan, and she's going to be, her stories are starting to just pour out. Again, I don't know where the Lutherans are. You know, they're not silent people, are we? We're a little bit loquacious. You know, they've got to come pouring out. Ruth's got many, many coming. Homestead Crescent is deliberately a peculiar title. The daughter goes home for a funeral and is dying to find out about the religious tradition, and the mother isn't interested, which reverses the normal thing of the parents trying to make sure that the children care about. It's just totally reversed. The daughter keeps asking, please, what was it like back then? What was it like? The mother says, I've got to watch Merv Griffin. Can you ask me tomorrow? It's really a nice one. So a few things if you want to read, and then we'll do dive around. Any questions?
These are going to be in the library.
Well, I'll have to ask where to put them. Where
on the reserve shelf in the library down here. The circulating library.
Read the story.
It's coming. I'm going to read you a tiny little preface to the story and then the story. She takes great liberties. She writes both as herself and as a fictional voice in this. And the first one I'm reading, just to prepare you for Shades of Sin, because we don't want to get into sin too fast, is Diana. And her name is Diana, so you'll see quickly what she's doing. I used to have a lot of trouble with my name. In Rhineland, where I grew up, people named their children Peter and Agnes and Sarah and Jacob. In fact, there was so much duplication of names, you might find yourself in the position of, say, Peter Peters, son of Peter Peters, son of Peter Peters. This wasn't as confusing as it sounds. There wasn't a lot of mail, and the identities of fathers and sons were not that clearly distinguished anyway. Most of the time you referred to people by their nicknames, which everybody knew, like Schwashepetash or Boa Johnson. What was an exotic name like Diana doing in a plain village like Rhineland? Not only did it lack the resonance of a long line of aunts and grandmothers who had the same name, it was hard for people to say. They would roll it around their tongues, tasting its foreignness, and then spit it out. A friend of my grandfather's once asked me, aren't you terribly depressed to have a name like that? My mother's cousin Souche was undaunted by it. She would hug me tight on her lap and tickle and squeeze me with her crippled hand, all the while crooning, Diantcha, Oba Diantcha, Oba Diantcha. Later, my brother and sister would follow me around mercilessly chanting, Diantcha, Oba Diantcha. Part of the joke was it sounded a lot like little duckling in Low German. We didn't get to read books much. And remember, this childhood is 15 years ago she stopped writing about. The school library was a tiny cupboard in the corner of the room. You could read through the entire collection in half a year, and you only got to switch rooms every 4 years. The public library, which came to town once a month in a van, was forbidden to us on grounds of worldliness. But we did get to hear a fantastic array of Bible stories. I was fascinated by their exotic foreign flavor. They always came with a moral attached at the end, which would relate them to our own plain little world, but it never came close to capturing their beauty and terror. It was extremely hard to see, for example, how the point of a story like the multicolored Joseph in Egypt being seduced by Potiphar's wife could possibly be that we shouldn't tell lies to our parents. I did find one story which I felt I could claim for my own. My second name is Ruth, so I paid particular attention to Ruth the Moabite, who followed her mother-in-law home and worked in the fields with her. Her faithfulness made her belong in spite of her foreign past. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. I clung to this story as a way of getting through the other passage from the Bible, which had to do with me whenever the minister in church read about the heathenish Diana of the Ephesians and the wickedness she caused among God's people. I modestly lowered my head and tried to look Ruth-like. I even told my teacher once to call me Ruth from now on. She smiled indulgently and instantly forgot. Later in high school, I discovered other more interesting stories about the goddess whose name I bore. Greek myths were okay to read as long as you didn't mix them up with the Bible. They were strictly classical references to explain the strange names strewn so improvidently through English literature which we had to read to get through grade 12. I found out Diana was a huntress and a moon goddess, both of which suited me fine. There weren't any forests around our farm, but I could easily imagine gliding among trees in buskins, and I was on intimate terms with the moon already. A ghostly galleon tossed upon cloddy seeds, she was also the virgin goddess, which worried me a lot during the time my twin sister Rosie and her friends were going on heavy dates, and I was sitting at home vacillating between the terror of acquiring breasts and periods and the shame of getting them so late. I liked the story of Actaeon, who was turned into a stag for spying on Diana. By this time, my friends were calling me Di, which I liked because it was short and neat, and it turned every greeting into a little song. Hi, Di. Bye, Di. The only problem with it was meeting new people who would usually raise their eyebrows and say, oh, you mean Diane. And even if I emphasized the A at the end of Diana, they would still invariably spell it with a double. And or some other unforgivable mistake. This problem was solved miraculously a few years ago by His Royal Highness, Prince Charles. He couldn't know, of course, that his choice of the future Queen of England would personally affect the identity of a missing Mennonite peasant girl from Rhineland. But it did. Since the advent of Lady Di, no one has ever questioned my name. In fact, it has given me my own modest taste of royalty. A 5-year-old girl at Victoria Albert School in Winnipeg came up to me one day and said, I saw you on TV. What was I doing on TV? I asked her, much surprised. Getting married, she said, to Prince Charles. So I felt like a princess one day. Going back to Rhineland now, I noticed several young Dianas swinging in the schoolyard and skipping in the ditches. Nothing feels as separate as everything once did. It's hard to tell anymore what's exotic and what's plain. I like it that way. Mm-hmm. Any comments? I see a whole lot of attention between
the experience of the world, the religious world and its expectations and the code of another world, the transition.
Is it still as dramatic? For, you know, this is unusual. There's no doubt about
it. Kids in Rhineland come down to Cavalier to attend the Eagle movie theater. You know, like when they're 17 and 18, they can come across a lot easier. Come across the border, they'll sneak away. And it's always, you can always tell the kids from Canada coming, they're looking over their shoulder, is a grandma's going to appear any minute? You know, they still, there's opponents, 5,000 people, there's no movie theater or roller rink or any of those kind of awful entertainments that come either towards Winnipeg or come into Cavalier, which is actually closer for them.
How many of you had anything forbidden?
Pardon?
How many of you had anything forbidden?
Forbidden?
Social behavior. Was it forbidden?
Yes, of course.
Is this, you know, does
yes.
It doesn't have to be the same context.
Excuse me, is this common for Mennonites to continue to university or education? And I was near a Mennonite community in northwest Montana that went through the 8th grade, and that was the extent of their education. They felt that was adequate.
It depends. There are Mennonite communities where an education is considered the goal, and there are ones that are particularly in, that consider independent education. They don't want to be part of the state system.
This is this way.
So it's hard to compare them.
One of the reasons why mm-hmm. There's 8 churches in Altona, you know, 8 Mennonite churches, and they're all different there.
Yeah.
This is
story.
Mm-hmm. These people go from the university, and I think it was like this and that.
So, that's Diana, and now her story.
Other than their own title college.
No, there's an incredibly high degree of education in those who choose to be educated. It varies with the different schism, I think. Shades of sin. I'll ask you to listen very closely for the plot, shall we say, the narrative comes in towards the end, which is the part we'll focus on most. it's an unusual story in that she adds up details and then moves towards an incident that she hasn't quite resolved in her mind. And here she's speaking in a fictional voice, not as the Diana. The temptations of men in Rhineland were blatant, contemptible, easily accomplished. I have one extra copy, I'm sorry. Is anyone in need of reading it and can't hear my voice very well? Okay. The temptations of men in Rhineland were blatant, contemptible, easily accomplished, and thrown away. Cigarettes at Yurchak, Sunday afternoons. Ancient, dust-curled calendar pictures of half-naked women. The gray, foreign monotony of TV on a tiny corner where somebody hold your head up too straight on the street or in church or forget yourself so far as to speak your own mind. It happened to the best of women once in a while, though in my family at least, they made up for it after with extra baking and sweet talk for weeks. The big one for Rosie and me was glamour, an obviously forbidden kind of worldliness, but with peculiarly undefined edges. A lot of our adolescent energies went into their exact location, trying to find the edges. The rules kept changing. That was the confusing part. We could understand, for example, that hair was an unruly item, best kept under kerchiefs and hats. It had a dangerous tendency to shine in the sun and spring into provocative curls, sometimes with a bit of prompting from Rosie and me. We like to blame nature as justification for our hair's behavior, though the most unsophisticated theologian among us could veto this claim easily by making reference to the fall. The point was partly to protect ourselves against the brutal demands of men whose biological urges, unlike our own, could not be helped. It was therefore up to us to keep them from getting unduly aroused, but mainly we suspected to prevent them from doing the thing itself. Also, beauty was altogether a disturbing category for Mennonites. No one knew quite what to do with it, even though God must have put it there for a reason if we could only know what it was. And yet, our mothers dared to disobey their own father's decrees so far as to cut and curl their hair and even administer the occasional home permanent to each other and sometimes to us children. That was okay, though, looking in the mirror longer than 30 seconds at a time, or admitting any pleasure whatsoever in the results was strictly taboo. The hats themselves were fraught with temptation. According to the Bible, women had to cover their hair for worship, a handy excuse for keeping one's Sunday headwear up to date. Though one of my aunts insisted wearing a hat meant wearing 100% cotton handkerchiefs from Gladstones tied around the chin. My mother, however, ordered her hats from Eaton's by mail. She favored a pleasant, middle-of-the-road style, neither too rakish nor too plain, light beige or navy blue with a bit of lace. Once they sent her a thin black hat with a net veil to cover the face. We loved this hat. It's dangerous mystique. She wouldn't wear it, however, until she figured out a way to tuck the veil in so it looked only an inch long. That was what bothered me most of all, the clear-cut, invisible lines of propriety which could not be argued or discussed and seemed obvious to everyone, except Rosie and me. It just didn't make sense. A necklace was acceptable to God up to, say, 2 strands if the beads were not too large or too brightly colored. But the tiniest bracelet plunged you immediately over into heathenism. Someone, who could it have been, gave my mother a set of fake diamonds. Once she wore the necklace to church with her embroidered blue checked cotton dress, but the earrings stayed on her dresser in a little case. We longed for those earrings. We fondled them. We screwed them secretly in our ears. She let us wear them sometimes for dress-up, but we had to be careful not to look exuberant or glamorous. A hard thing when you're 8 and wearing diamonds. Or my dad would threaten to take them away to chasten our pride. She had several items like this. A pair of white satin gloves, the long kind that reached past the elbow and featured a slit at the wrist to tuck in the hand part if you were at a ball and sitting down to dinner. A pair of red leather shoes with open toes and 3-inch heels, never worn. And she had a pair of short pink gloves with white pearls sewn at the wrist. How did these things come to be in Rhineland, in my mother's dresser? When asked, she would smile vaguely and murmur something about changing her mind. When I was 10, a group of village mothers organized an educational tour to Winnipeg for their children. We left in the morning by bus. Rosie and I, wearing blue pedal pushers our mother whipped up late the night before on the Singer sewing machine. Our first stop was CKY. I can't for the life of me imagine how such a worldly radio station got on the agenda, since we weren't allowed to listen to anything but CFAM in Rhineland. I don't remember anything about the tour itself except the lady who showed us around. She was the most glamorous person we'd ever laid our innocent eyes on. We feasted on her gloriously wicked appearance all up and down the halls of the CKY building. From her dubiously spiked gray leather heels to her blue shaded eyelids. The best thing by far was her bracelet, a silver chain hung, we could hardly believe it, hung with dimes. There must have been hundreds of them rattling and jingling as she talked. We spent half the trip home later discussing this fascinating item, calculating its worth, its glitter, its sinfulness, its waste. Our second stop was the Christie Cookie Factory. Our mothers were more at home here and more relaxed. We watched thousands of tiny rectangle biscuits slipping off conveyor belts and being stuck together with lemon yellow icing. Impressive, but most of us agreed the results fell far short of the baking we were used to at home. Our third stop was the museum after lunch. Someone decided we should split into smaller groups to walk through it. Since there was no tour guide, we would be on our own. Rosie and I stayed with our mother. We made a great mistake walking into the museum. Our group somehow made a wrong turn and ended up in the art gallery on the other side. I don't know what we would have seen in the museum had we ever found it, but what we saw instead was mind-boggling. Huge empty rooms with nothing but pictures on the walls. And such pictures, nothing pretty or picturesque like the calendars at home, only weird smudges which gave you a strange feeling in the belly. My mother, embarrassed and sweaty about the mistake, hurried us through them, still hoping for stuffed buffaloes and red coats on wooden mannequins somewhere, but she only led us deeper into the labyrinth of art. The most incredible room of all was the very last, hung all around with naked women in various poses, our first glimpse of the shape our own bodies were destined to become. I would have liked to stay in this room a while and sort out the strange emotions aroused by this totally new vision of the world, but for the sake of our education, we rushed on and made it out just as the last of the other groups emerged from the museum, so easily located after all, just across the big hall. My mother, of course, turned the whole adventure into an episode in getting lost, sorting through inch by inch the wrong turns we had made, and our good fortune in getting out at all. She never mentioned the room full of naked women, and neither did we. There didn't seem to be any words for it, but it stayed in my memory as a kind of promise, touching some deeper hunger than I had known. I, untouched by more familiar shades of sin. Comments in general? I think there's one character in particular that we need to look at in there.
It absolutely rings true with my childhood in Morton, Minnesota, in terms of knowing, somehow knowing what was okay and what was going too far in terms of clothes. Or I can remember how shocked I was in college when I came home from a summer of lifeguarding at a camp and my hair had been bleached blonde and it was starting to grow in dark because it was winter again. And my aunt, of all people, said, well, why don't you just dye it blonde? That was going too far. And it was sinful. It was not okay to suggest such a thing. And as children, we knew, absolutely. The girl in my eighth grade who got pregnant at the end of the year was the girl Terry Ann Bulin, who wore full circle skirts much longer than any of the rest of us, with extra crinolines.
And this was the cause, no doubt.
With all those crinolines, it got her pregnant.
I love both the preface and the story because I think it's really a common thing in every child's life, no matter what situation they're in, of knowing or being told so many don'ts, and then sorting those out through the rest of your years, and when, you know, you finally reject a lot of those don'ts in order to find yourself, and it's a really painful period. And she did it really.
What in general do all the don'ts relate to here? You know, if you start adding up the incidents, she's got lovely details of what's forbidden.
Seduction.
Sexuality, largely, is it not? You know, the anything to enhance the attractiveness is forbidden.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that there was some comment about pride, which I find is in a church setting is usually directed at male ego kinds of things, but it's women who listen more carefully to those and beat themselves a little bit more. But here it is, and it has to do with the glamour, you know, not wanting to be glamorous or show off, you can be public, and we're playing things.
And very dismissive. Well, this isn't about accomplishments, but very dismissive about accomplishments is one of the things that's showing up in Ruth's writing, is that your inability to do anything well, because if you've done it well, you have to immediately discount it and deny it and just diminish it, because it'd be too...
I probably wasn't affected by this as much as my older sisters, but she tells the story of where she had to go to a Christmas service with a coat. She had to wear this dreadful coat, and underneath she had a hole. There was a hole in her dress. I mean, my parents were poor, but my mother was a seamstress in a certain sense, but somehow there just was not time to sew this. And so when she got up to speak, and she had her hat on also, she didn't take her hat off, she kept her coat on. And when she got home, she just got a terrible tongue lashing and also a physical spanking from my mother for being so full of pride that she could not take that coat off, even though her clothing underneath was not appropriate, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember that for later on too, that I would have to wear old-fashioned things, you know, that just crushed me as a child. Mm-hmm. But now don't be proud, you know, wear that. And that really did leave a mark on me.
What about the mother in this story? You know, right. Theoretically, she's the one that's responsible for Rosie and the narrator. But she's full of ambiguity, I think, or full of sufficient complexity.
Sure, I know where she got the red shoes.
That's what I
It was obviously no mistake that they didn't get to the museum.
Yeah.
Oh. In my opinion.
Yeah, how many of you agree that
there's
so few ways she's going to accomplish what she wants to accomplish? There's a great debate when I did this story before that this was an accident and the mother was obviously, you know, she'd given up. But if she'd given up that other world, why hadn't she left whatever she changed her mind or wherever she'd come from? Those things were still in the closet for the kids to...
It was interesting to me that she let the children see those fancy two pairs of gloves and the shoes and the jewelry.
The diamond earrings they played with.
And let them play with and try on, but almost secretly. It's almost like she didn't want the men folks to know. Mm-hmm. You know, it was
real angry. Mm-hmm.
So she wanted the children to have a glimpse of a different world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then I begin to think it's interesting to ask, where has she come from? Is she a Rhinedon? Because the children are not going to be suffocated in the way she's discovered she's suffocated, perhaps unknowingly. I have seen no other piece that could connect with this. Dan's done a lot of short pieces, some of which integrate, but nothing else has touched this, which I think is the best of the ones she's done. The notion of the mother as an outsider and acting as a subterfuge, you know.
What is that great line about stumbling into the world of art?
Into the labyrinth of art, I think. And art there is capitalized A. She only led us deeper into the labyrinth of art, away from the buffalo, and that's obviously the mounted police, you know, statue, the red coats on it. Canadian mounted police. Our first glimpse of the shape our own bodies were destined to become. The narrator's view of the mother, however, isn't ours, is it? Does the narrator have any sense that the mother was deliberately encouraging them?
Probably not at age 10. Couldn't pick up on it. But I know the very museum she writes about, and it's very easy to have found the Natural History Museum and not the art right next to it. So it almost sounds like the mother was gently allowing the kids to see something else. Yet she wouldn't realize it until she was older.
A lot of the stories that I found in looking for this notion of this combination of what is called a religious community, and yet this seems to me nothing to do with doctrine or religious practice. It's the fear of sexuality, it seems to me, that is it comes under the umbrella of this is what's okay in this culture and code. Mothers come in for a pretty bad press. This is one of the more beautiful ones, that indirectly you see a mother as saying that's part of our human experience. And it's very subtly done. Mothers are often complicit in attempting to, what's the word, or portrayed as complicit in attempting to define.
Well, there's an assumption that what the women do somehow allows men to avoid their more gross sins, and causes me to think about what is much more blatant, like in an Islamic culture, religious culture, where everything is aimed at removing from men's sights erotic things.
And that's how she explains it initially, isn't it? We are responsible, our behavior is responsible. In fact, that's how she starts, the temptations for men.
Uh-huh.
Actually, she starts with the temptations for men and women, but what she says is the temptations in Ryland for men were blatant, contemptible, easily accomplished, and thrown away.
Yeah.
And she doesn't list any of the ones that involve women. It's cigarettes and calendars of half-naked women and the monotony of TV on a shelf. It's kind of interesting given what comes later, which is my entire life will be contained to keep them from sinning.
Do you see her as coming from a different life? You said there's a question whether she was from Ryland previously?
The mother?
Yes.
Well, it is curious, isn't it? I don't think it's...
I see. The mother is just a normal person who has temptations, the red shoes or whatever.
She may have bought all those things one by one herself, of course, didn't she?
Or just ordered a mail order. Like
mail order for Eden's, yes.
Got it secretly.
I like that possibility. Do you see that?
Frederick's of Hollywood, sort of, or Mennonite.
Do their husbands share a delight in those things, or?
Well, now the husband never does show up, does he? The little girl knows the white gloves, you know, you pull it back and you tuck it in. Do you remember those? You've seen your prom, you know, how many buttons there? And the little girl knows that. Who's told her? Obviously, mother. I don't know if Eden stocks those either. That's where the mother orders most of her stuff.
Don't you think a lot of those things, though, a generation maybe earlier, Lutheran piety, depending on which branch a person was subjected to. There was a beautiful article about 2 years ago when the merger of the Lutheran churches being contemplated in the Fargo newspaper about North Dakota Lutheran piety, and there's all kinds of incredible schisms even amongst Norwegian Lutherans. Mm-hmm. What cards were allowed? No cards at all to... Well, maybe old maid was okay. And then this gal who was writing the article, this woman that wrote it, said, I was in the devil may care group where the men could sneak off to the back room for poker. You know, and you know, writing about Norwegian Lutheran, specifically in that case, piety and all of the different groups, kind of like the Mennonites even yet today, but her writing was from the 20s.
You see, I don't know any place, in, this is why I started, I don't know any place in fiction where this particular tension between behavior, which may be petty and ridiculous, and we can laugh about what kind of cards, and is poker okay, and can you get a permanent. I don't know any place where that's, and that's rich detail, that's a transition from one way of life to the next, is it not? I mean, it seems to me it's a watershed. I think the writing began in Canada before the watershed finished, and I think the watershed, this is my own theory, the watershed has come and gone without our capturing it in writing. The details in themselves are boring, but they're rich, rich texture for if you're going to do a fiction setting where there is conflict and there is characterization. Rovog, if that's the last of the of a writer that might inhabit a world that some of you are connected to, was long before this necessity to delineate behavior that was appropriate in the new world. That's why I think you should all rush home and get your pens. You know, if you have any experience or any vision of this or any, it's a transition time, is it not? It's that time when there was a small ethnic religious community that was self-contained to what is now, we're looking at multiculturalism in our church, and it's an inevitable and a good and a salutary outcome, but somewhere along we haven't told the story, I don't think.
Well,
you can ask me why is it important to tell the story. I mean, that's a useful question. I, because I'm a fiction writer, think it's desperately important to tell a people's story. I don't see it's been told. And it's not that we tell it to ridicule or whatever. It's just that it hasn't been told. What?
It seems that that religion is just finding, people are just discovering, at least people in my age group, are just discovering that the religious background is of some influence. I know a lot of people my age that are coming out of the stage of negating that, and now that they have children, are trying to determine in their values and the ways in which they're raising their children, where did these come from, and how can I begin to name them and identify them, and either claim them or reject them, but at least claim them for the sense of that they're part of my history. Yeah. So I see that now is the perfect time for that to be coming out and to enable people to identify just what is all of that. Mm-hmm. I was trying, as you were talking, in terms of books that identify Lutheran groups, Lutheran upbringing in mm-hmm. fiction. I come from a United Methodist background, and I was trying desperately to identify something for myself, and also am not...
And I mean to go larger, the Protestant experience, I think, which is not the Jewish experience we can find in many different settings, and Roman Catholic, I think we can find in different places, but the Protestant prairie settlement is not...
Yeah, well, you get the Baptist. Mm-hmm. You know, the revival and all of that comes in various ways, both in television and fiction in lots of ways, but...
I think it's something to do with the value we put on story, the notion of story in our tradition. Mm-hmm. And forgive me or argue, but how do we use story, or argue with me, how do we use story in our religious experience or practice? How is story used?
Moralistically. Yeah.
And I don't think that's too strong to say, is it? Mm-hmm. To teach a lesson, mm-hmm. or... How else? Illustrative point. But the use to which story, the storyteller, the storytelling, the nature of story. I mean, what's ironic is that the scripture depends on story. The story is told and finished, and nobody ever comes up and says, "Now this is what it means," or "That's the point," or "Did you all get it?" It stands on its own, I think, the best of the stories.
When I was in seminary, I took a course in storytelling. It was the only one offered in my whole 4 years, but I took it, and it was interesting because shortly after I finished that course in chapel at seminary, someone preached, and their sermon basically was a story, mm-hmm. and everybody was furious. Okay, you told the story, you didn't tell us what to do with it, how to understand
it. What does it mean?
Yeah, you need to tell us that, or it's not a sermon. Yeah.
I think somebody who has done that for the Lutherans in recent times, although he himself is not a Lutheran, and he's much more effective on the radio
is Garrison Keillor.
Yeah.
And he really has represent. I mean, it's almost like a cult across the country. You'd think he was a Lutheran pastor or a Lutheran theologian.
But it's certainly not a story where it's very open-ended.
Yeah.
Part of its appeal is that it isn't.
Yeah.
I'm wondering too if Walter Wangerin doesn't kind of fit
Wangerin.
Into this.
And he certainly is aware or uses the notion of story as an independent, not as something you plug into the middle of a sermon or in the middle of your lecture, but as an entity in
That's
itself.
Right.
I don't know when I'm supposed to end, when the bell rings at 5 or 10 minutes ago. Or,
yeah.
You were going to say 10 minutes.
Yeah, I really appreciate everything you're saying about. That has this line about rediscovering a kind of identity, you know, because I think for some reason this seems to be a time in history where all kinds of groups, you know, Jews and Catholics and gays and all kinds of groups are looking at their own history and saying, we were hurt in these particular ways, and we also gained these particular things by having this common heritage or common experience, and it's so valuable to be sharing that, and I mean, in fact, that's one reason I'm here. Is to see how does it feel to be with lots and with presumably a lot of Lutherans, and I think that's a tremendous value of what we're talking about, and also how stories can fit into that, is to all of us reflect on what is it, what have we gained and what have we lost by being Lutherans, and then what do we do with that?
I really feel I have to say this every time, I have to caution against just the Lutheran story. It's that I suppose is the. You know, is what you say, the foundation of Holden. It's the Lutheran and the others, but thank you, yes. I don't want to imply that that's the only story I'm interested in, but that I, as a Lutheran, went to Lutherans. Yeah, I agree. I think your most powerful way of connecting that, of holding onto it, of giving it to somebody else, is in story. It's not in a documentary, and it's not in any sort of statements of fact. If you really want a powerful rendition of what you're talking about, of saving and sharing, it has to be in fiction. And fiction for its own sake, you know, not with the point of showing somebody else what your history is or what your pride is. And there's a real fine line there. I find myself reluctant to show any of my relatives. This is terrible. Don't repeat this to them. I'm careful about who I show my writing to, because we all came from a tradition where there was a point. And I don't want to have to, I cannot write if I have to. I can't use up any energy discussing that theoretical point. I would like at some point, I think, to share with some people who came from the same tradition I did, where we learned story in that way, where it was to illustrate. But at the moment, to protect my own ability to write, I've kept myself very clear of that.
I was just thinking very much.